resolve the problem incorrectly. Shall we try to get this to be just what would have been said at the time when the Bible was written? Or shall we try to put it into something that would be intelligible to the present-day reader? It involves the problem. The King James translators tended to follow where they weren't sure exactly how to put something. They would try to speak as close as they could to precisely what they found in the Hebrew. But these places were given certain ancient times by their own people. And then when the Hebrew speaks about in another country, the question is, how are they going to put that name into their own language? And they basically obliterate, try to pronounce it as it is, so they may have a different way to say it. Like even today, we speak the city of Rome. We write R-O-M-E. In Italy, they would say Roma, R-O-M-A. And in Germany, they would simply write R-O-M. And books, maps in English, up till a few years ago, always gave an anglicized form for such words. And nowadays, it's a custom many maps to give the form in the language of the area, and often that means absolutely nothing. We only just read. So there's a problem here. But in this case, of course, we're not going to now in the exact amount of detail applied to the way that we see what it means and how it comes to be what it is. And as I said, the Hebrew is the form that the Hebrew might use, which would represent what the Egyptian used, either by transliterating or perhaps by translating the idea of the word that in the Hebrew. But then Alexander the Great conquered Greece about 300 years after this was written. And from that time on, for the next 300 years, I get to say for 500 years, Egypt was controlled by Greek rulers and a Greek ruling class. And consequently, some of the names of the places were translated into Greek. In other cases, the Greeks, for one reason or another, adopted a different word. And those are the words that we find in our history books today, the words that the Greeks gave to these places. And so the recent translation follows the practice of giving the name that would be familiar to a present-day situation, which is the Greek word, even though that was not used for 300 years after the world. And so the three words that name the places that occur twice in this passage, one of them is Memphis, and that occurs in the King James in the form Nope, N-O-P-A. And there's one passage in the King James Bible where instead of N-O-P-A, they have N-O-P-A. But the Egyptian would be Men-Nofer. And this Men-Nofer in the Hebrew would simply be abbreviated to either Mo or more commonly to No. And then the city that the Greeks called Memphis, is the last one right here. And then the city that Hebrew called No is a city which was dedicated to the god Amun, the leading god of Egypt during the latter centuries of ancient Egyptian history. And No Amun means the city of Amun. And since it was one of the most prominent and important cities of ancient Egypt, they came to call it simply city. And we find it in Syria, an occasional reference to that, and simply calling it No, as it is called in the King James Version. But the modern reader knows it by the Greek name of Thebes. And so, in our recent translation, they all do as Thebes. Then the other city, the third one, Hebrews use the word sin, which in the Hebrew is a word meaning marsh. Mark, and Plato. And that is a translation of the Greek. But the Greeks took their Greek word for that, Palouse, and they made it Pelusian. And so we have the Greek names of all three of these people. So that's why there was a Greek version of the paraphrase between the King James and the Hebrew, and I hope that those of you who didn't mention Pelusian were sin, did through a misunderstanding, but they were over. But not what it said, what he said. He said, I will pour out my wrath on Pelusian. He said, Pelusian will ride in agony. Pelusian is a city which is a northeastern end of Egypt. Now, Egypt in ancient times was very fortunate in that it had a desert to the west, the desert to the south, a large part of the east. And then the sea on the north. And so there was, except coming down from Asia, there was no easy way to attack Egypt. And that relative safety that Egypt had enabled them to have a high civilization during many centuries and was very considerable in Asia. But if Asiatics attacked Egypt, the first place they would come to would be this place that the Hebrews called Sin. Later called Pelusium. Now there's nothing very unusual about this statement. I will pour out my wrath on Pelusium. Pelusium will lie in an agony. So nobody understands that what she's saying. They could be said of almost any situation comes. And the most that he's upon. Because most resistant have been subject to disease and destruction. All sorts of misery. Now then, the city that the Greeks called Thebes is a city which, during the later part of the Egyptian history, or ancient Egyptian history, was perhaps the most important city in Egypt. It was the city from which the men had come to become the great pharaohs. And in that area of Thebes, they put up temples, many temples, to the god Amun and to other gods. It is today probably the greatest outdoor museum anywhere in the world for this city of ancient Thebes. It is far south of what you put on your map. It is in the desert coming almost to it, but it was a great center for this family that ruled Egypt for many years. It was their main headquarters, and most of them, at that later part of ancient Egyptian, were buried near that city of Thebes. Now, what do we find here? Prediction about Thebes. We find it that I will cut off the horns of Thebes. And then in the next word, Thebes will be taken by storm. Well, most people think Thebes will be taken by storm sometime or other. Nothing to do with that. I will cut off the horns of Thebes. That is perhaps a little more unusual, but not so very, because you say Babylon, which has been absolutely deserted for many centuries. And some of the ancient cities, many have that been reused as a lot of ruins. But I will cut off the horns, might seem to fit quite nicely with what you find to be today, because there are very few people living like that in your near future. But as they say, it's the greatest outdoor museum in the world. I have a picture taken in front of a statue there in front of the pharaohs, which was so high that as I stood in front of it, my head only came to its knees. And it was built in that proportion. And there is an avenue there through the ruins of Thebes, which to this day has large statues, many times larger than man, on both sides of the land, going for many, many half miles. It is a city with great amounts of ruins. It is a city with the many remainders of the ancient Egyptian gods. Now then, the other city here is nothing. of Midway Beam. The white area of the delta is north of it. The long area that's along the shores of the Nile is south of it. And this is the very, at the very beginning of Egyptian history. A king named Menes was established with the first to unite all of Egypt into one nation. And he established his capital right where there's two main sections of Egypt, which were designated Upper and Lower Egypt, and represented separately many of the rest of the region, just like even the sky. Represented separately in mentions of Great Britain. And in fact, the Scotch flag and the English flag were united together to make what they call the Union Jack. Similarly, Memphis was right where these two people together, and their meetings and the succeeding pharaoh for many years had their capital. Now, it would seem to stand to reason that Memphis would have had just as many statues of gods built in the idols as Thebes had in ancient times. What we find about Memphis, that he said, I will destroy the idols and put them in the image of Memphis. He said later on, Memphis will be in constant distress, but I have to say, almost in his city over a period of centuries. But that first statement there, I will destroy the idols and put them in the image of Memphis, is the various predictions about ancient countries that you have noticed. You did not see anything parallel to this state. It is a very unusual statement to make. I will destroy the idols and put an end to the images in Memphis. It's a very unusual statement in general. And then the interesting thing is that it is said specifically about Memphis, and it is not said about Thebes. Now in Thebes, they have all these many images, the great statues standing there today. And when it comes to idols, there was a little building there among the ruins of Memphis, about maybe half as high as this room, a building made of stone about as long as this room. And I stepped up to the entrance of that where there was, and there, custodian sitting in front of the entrance, with dressed with a long white flowing garment, represented the Department of Antiquities. I showed him my permission from the Department of Antiquities, which I had secured in Cairo, and he got up and went to the door of this building and opened the door with his key. And I stepped in to a room about a third as long as this room, and about as wide as it was long. And there was nothing in it, as far as you could see, a bare empty room, and the only light that came into that rather small door between them. Then he went through a little door, an open door, that is, a door space without a natural door. And from there into a second room about the same size. And there was much less light, because the light came only through the outer door in the first room, into this room, and there was nothing in that as far as I could see. Then he stepped into the third room about the same size, and there it was practically dark, and he took a little tape and lit it and held it up, and there you could see what looked like a pulpit, like this, the end of the room, and seated on top of it was like a chair, and seated on that was a statue of the monkey-headed god Thoth of ancient Egypt. And here was this idol, which has been there for the last 3,000 years or more. Still there, these statues, which have the great high images that have been there for 3,000 years, dozens of them. Now suppose that Ezekiel has said, I will destroy the idols and put an end to the images in Thebes. Well, you would have to say 3,000 years have passed. Well, this particular year, 2,500 years have passed. And Thebes is full of images and full of idols. Perhaps as much as any city, the remains of any city anywhere in the world. But he didn't say that about Thebes. He said that about Memphis. Now, if Ezekiel visited Memphis, which I doubt he would, her. Yes. That indeed became her mother's report. But Memphis was still located where the delegate gathered there. And even though the kings had their ritual headquarters, indeed, they went back there very frequently for their ceremonies and all that. And buried there, Memphis was a great administrative center, even a great commercial city in Egypt at the time of Ezekiel and for thousands of years. And so it would seem extremely unlikely that Memphis did not also have a great many images and fires at the time of Ezekiel and for many centuries after Ezekiel's time. In fact, near Memphis, a place has a discovery was made within the last couple of centuries of an underground place, like a catacomb, which had a great many ancient bulls, which had been worshipped in later Egyptian history. That is, after the time of Christ, one after another, these bulls, and when one died, they could mummify it and put it into this seraphim, as they called it, for the worship of this bull that was in the early Christian centuries, the center of the Holy Spirit. And that is what you meant, that is underground, and they were bulls only, they were not dead. But why would change like that take place in Memphis? Why would the Jews rise, disappear from Memphis? Why would they remain in Thebes? Indeed. And how would Ezekiel ever know there was a difference? God clearly led him to make a very strange statement about Memphis, which had been made about the Jews 3,000 years ago. By this is not the fulfillment, maybe a guess, but it certainly would not be an evidence of the fact that an intelligence and knowledge of the future was behind the Ezekiel, guiding him in his work. Now we have a few very definite evidences like this of the great knowledge of the one who directed the prophets and the writers of the Bible. There are a great many statements, they're all true, but a great deal, which was in one place as well as another, or which perhaps was in many different places. There are comparatively few like this, but there are many, like what we know from Isaiah, and I think even more than an evidence of an intelligence that went far beyond what any human being would have had. Now, how does it come about that all the images and idols that is practical of Memphis would have disappeared? It came about this way that about 1,000 years passed after Ezekiel wrote. And then, at about 600 AD, a great number of extremely fanatical warriors from Arabia came and attacked Egypt and conquered Egypt. And these men were followers of Mohammed, and were declared that there is one God, and Mohammed is his prophet. And to everyone they met in Egypt, in Persia, in all that area, the followers of Mohammed gave a choice between accepting the Quran or the sword. You accept the Quran and become Muslim, or we will kill you. Now they did not make that choice to Jews or Christians, because they considered them as believing in God, but as having a distorted idea of it. The Muslims accept the Bible as being a true book, an inspired book of God, but they say that it has been corrupted, the changes have been made in it. And what they do accept it, in theory, and Christians or Jews were not killed in the Muslims, but were allowed to remain subject to the Muslims, paying extra heavy taxes and being under great restrictions, but still allowed to continue. And he became one of the great centers of Judaism for a number of centuries. in the middle of the year. Not only Muslims came that way, they came to Memphis, and they conquered Memphis, and they decided to build a new capital, which would not have been the idol, a capital that never would have been any idolatry. And so across the river, and just a slight short distance north, they built a colony called Ostet. And that remained their capital for quite a number of years. And then, shortly after 900 AD, about 2 centuries after the conquest, they proceeded to build a new capital a little north of Memphis, the city of Cairo. So Cairo is one of the great cities you would find over in those lands that is not ancient, that is 1,000 years old. It is not an ancient city at all, but Cairo is the largest city in Egypt today, the capital of Egypt. Yes?
I guess I was going away. You say that the Arabian warriors did in fact take away the idol and the images and they,
Yes, correct. They wanted, and the thieves, they knocked some of them over. There's a certain amount of destruction. They drove away the people there, and the people done another one in the little village in the east with no importance in the east. But the Memphis, they wanted to have their capital near the center of Egypt, where it would have the power of the Romans. First Ostat and then Cairo. And therefore, they started from scratch to build a city, and they have the most one of the big cities in the world in Cairo. And they had to have material for their building. And so they tore down the building of Memphis, including the images and the items, broke the material up so they could carry it, folded it across the Nile, and carried it north of the short distance. And the fact that Cairo was built more than 1,000 years after the near the place of ancient Memphis, resulted in all the images, practically, and idols of Memphis being broken up into stone for the building of the building of Cairo. And Ezekiel could not have known about the coming of Islam, humanly. He could not have known that they would build a new capital near Memphis, not near Thebes. He could not have known that it would be any place. So, I doubt Ezekiel personally had much idea of why God would say, I will destroy the idols and put them into the images of men, and not say anything about them. But today we can look at things and see these dozens of great images and these many idols still remaining after thousands of years. We can go to where ancient Memphis was and we find just a fine form in which there have been some excavations made during the last century, and they have dug up a recumbent statue of Ramses II, one of the great of the pharaohs, a statue as long as this room, was lying in the ground, broken into three parts, and covered over. They have excavated it, and you can see it there today. And one statue of Ramses II, and there is another small statue, and then all the images of God. But call your attention to one other brief statement here in verse 13, which would not enter our assignment today because it doesn't refer to being a city. But he says, I will destroy the idols and put an end to the images in Memphis. No longer will there be a prince in Egypt. And that is the point of Jesus. No longer will there be a prince in Egypt. Now, if there was any place, you would not expect that statement to be made about it. It would be Egypt. Because the Egyptians were extremely nationalistic from very early on. In fact, in the hieroglyphics, whenever they have a name of a foreigner, even if he is the king of the Hittites or some other group with whom they are making an alliance. The sign in Egyptian hieroglyphics that means a foreigner is a picture of a man with his hands tied behind his back and blood streaming from his forehead. In other words, it's what the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, imagined and wished all the foreigners to be like. And they were extremely nationalistic during some centuries, during a couple thousand years of ancient history. And then, not so long after Ezekiel wrote, Egypt was conquered by the Babylonians, who then conquered by the Greeks, then held by the Romans, and eventually was held by the Turks. And the long line of the pharaohs that ruled the part of the Egypt came to an end. Long after the Egyptian and the land of all that land did not wish to have foreign rulers, and has not for any length of time since that time had a native ruler, a prince of the land. And so, this other statement is similar in way of this same passage, showing the supernatural intelligence that was directly Ezekiel in what he wrote.
Yes? What would you say, Dr. Craig, the idea that even today, the leaders of Egypt, well, of course, Egypt just got freed from the British in this century,
yes.
So that even today, the leaders of Egypt are not really native Egyptians, but
of course, Egypt does not have a prince anymore. It was theoretically a monarchy.
Okay, so don't have a prince. What about the leaders that some say Sadat or who were really native Egyptians and such?
Yes, they had a solid influence. The Turkish background was the ruler of Egypt for many years. And it was held by the foreigners most of that time in the short and for a long period of Greek people when you had the columns, Greek speaking, and Greek culture, Greek life in every way. But taking on some of the forms of Egypt.
Would your current leaders of Egypt, like Sadat and Hussein Mubarak, would they be considered Egyptians? Or?
I think they would call them prince. Well, let's get back then to our general survey of the material.
Given of each section, and we cannot know Lord, I'm all forgiven for the next thing happens right in that month, or whether it's spread over a period up to the next month. In Jeremiah, it does not follow a chronological order. In Jeremiah, we have something later, something earlier, all mixed together. There's more of a logical order instead of chronological. But in Ezekiel the third, that's the chronological order with specific statements as well. Particular prophecies were given. But the further prophecy before the sea, chapters 20 to 24. And I'll just mention what I call chapter 8, further indictment to the sin. 20 verse 1 to 21, 17. One should be able to derive much of value from careful study of these passages. They have much relevance to us today of our own sin and disobedience to God, but they are specifically in the first verse of the issue, and the selection of it. I've never mentioned some of them. But chapter B is very interesting. Chapter B, Babylonian attack on Jerusalem is imminent. And that is chapter 21, verses 18 to 27. Chapter 21, verses 18 to 27. And there we find that Ezekiel 21, 18 to 27, we find the statement, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, Mark Al-Tubo, for the sword of the king of Babylon, and they both started from the same country. Make a signpost where the road branches off to the city. And of course, the city would be the city of Jerusalem. Mark out one blow for the sword to come against the battle of the Ammonites. This was across the Jordan, the area of the Ammonites, the area in which the modern town of Ammon is the capital of the modern country of Jordan. And he says another against Judah and fortified Jerusalem. For the king of Babylon will stop at the fork of the road at the junction of the two roads to seek an omen. This was a custom in ancient times to seek an omen before undertaking anything or even crossing the river. When the Roman army came to a river, they had to stop and take an omen. They would count the number of birds they saw in the sky and see what direction they were going in. Very quickly for the moon to show them whether they should go ahead or one way or the other way or whether they should go back. And this is very important in the time. And so, we like to look back at these people in the ancient times and think how foolish they were to just be coming from home. But I heard a man say on TV recently, I don't know how much glory he had. But he said that 3/4 of the people of the United States know the signs of the zodiac, and that 1/4 of the people of the United States definitely believe that their lives are affected by the sign of the zodiac that they were born under. Well, that's about as silly a superstition as anything you find anything at any time. And so, our great progress probably as much superstition in the world today as it was in ancient times. But someone could have thought before. But here, and it says, if people battling the country is judged from the two worlds, he will cast lot with arrows. And it's very technique for casting lot with arrows. He will consult his idol. That would be another way of casting lot in relation to his idol. Then he will examine the liver. And I wonder During the period between, say, between the time of Christ, earlier, and the last century or century and a half, I wonder how many people had any idea what this meant. He will examine the liver. I was speaking at the inauguration of Father President once, and was speaking before me how he had given an address somewhere, and he'd given for this title, Looking at the River. And he said that they made a mistake in the program, and it said Looking at the River. And he described that as a very comical error that he made. And I had to call attention to this verse in Ezekiel, actually that is a good scriptural idea. Not only looking at the river, but also looking at the liver. Representations on clay tablets of liver, showing they killed an animal and examined its liver and made a picture of the condition of the bone, the liver of this animal, and then shortly after that it came by. So if you point an animal to a liver like that, beware of the things that die. And so on, they have hundreds of pictures of liver that were excavated through the last 100 years that the ancient Babylonians had a means of determining the future. I think just a sense of what the sun is looking at. But that it does not, of course, really prove anything. But it's interesting that this fact of ancient history is probably forgotten for 1500 years, but we have preserved the mention of it here in Ezekiel. I wonder if during the years, during the centuries when the books of the Old Testament were being popular reading, I mean, after Babylon had died in utter desolation for some centuries, I wonder if people wondered what on earth that meant and thought there might be a biographical error in the manuscript. But they copied it carefully. And that is a wonderful error, not of God having inspired it, but of the care with which the Old Testament books were preserved. That many things did not make much sense after so much of the conditions of the ancient world were lost and had disappeared, and before modern archaeology had gained knowledge of them. And yet the statements were preserved exactly and kept for the whole year. We have many small variations in our minds. But impossible to copy a book of sight of Ezekiel without making a number of mistakes in copying. It's almost impossible to have to read over many times before you get rid of all the mistakes. But the books of the Bible, and certainly the Old Testament, have been preserved with an accuracy that you cannot do for anything else in ancient times that has been copied and recopied. And so it says that he looks at the liver, and his right hand will come to watch for Jerusalem, where he's to set up battering rams to give the command to slaughter the son of the battle cry and set battering rams against the gate to build a ramp that can erect the siege works. And of course, the Babylonian king had twice established himself as a control over Jerusalem. The king had promised to be obedient to them, and then the king had sent down the heat, trying to get help from the Egyptians in order to throw out the yoke of the king of Babylon. And by this time, the Babylonians had determined they weren't going to put up with any more. So when the army came into Jerusalem, the people of Jerusalem knew that there was absolutely no safety in surrendering to the Babylonians. And so it was just at least a year and a half that with the army round about and having the what they control inside the city until finally the Babylonian throw food at the wall and destroy the city. But here we have Ezekiel telling when the king of Babylon was going in order to start his attack. And then prophet goes on in verse 25, O profane and wicked prince of Israel. He does not call that a by king, though he considered the way as the true king who was in exile. He comes the old profane and wicked prince of Israel, whose day has come to find punishment and reached its climax. Well, now that, of course, is a terrible thing, the way in which he speaks of Zedekiah. And yet Zedekiah is one who, I think, had to quite an extent a desire to stand for what was right. And Zedekiah, I think, in an ordinary time, would have been a man who would go through the thorns of trying to prove to God, even if his heart wasn't incomplete. But he was in a situation there where he went along with the tide, and therefore his influence came for that which was wicked. And so Ezekiel speaks of him in this strong way. I base that on what you find out about in Jeremiah, where he saved Jeremiah's life, and he asked Jeremiah to tell him what the Lord's will was, and what was going to happen, and Jeremiah said, go out and surrender to the Bible, and his life will be spared. And then I said, well, if I start to do that, these nobles here will kill me, and he prayed to do it. So, not so much to what he actively did as through his failure to resist the evil of those around him. He deserved what Ezekiel called the profane and wicked prince of Israel, whose day has come, whose time of punishment has reached its climax. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Take off the turban, remove the crown. It will not be as it was. The lowly will be exalted, will be exalted, will be brought low. A ruin, I will make it a ruin. It will not be restored until he comes to whom it rightfully belongs. To him I will give it. And Zedekiah was the last of the house of David to rule over Israel until it came to the Lord Jesus Christ. And God had told David that he would always have a son to sit on his throne. But the line came, seemed to come to an end to Zedekiah. And the Lord said here that it would be brought low. I will make it a ruin. It will not be restored until he comes to whom it rightfully belongs. And this in the Hebrew is the one whom it is to him. The one that shares the Lord. The one whom it is to him. The one to whom it rightfully belongs. Now this as share, this which we would translate as quick, or that as relative. The Asher is sometimes shorter than just the letter G. We find a number of such uses. And most interpreters agree that that is what was done in relation to the book of Genesis, Genesis 49, where we have the, this ship, which is a shortening of Asher, which we do find to be followed by the low, which means it belongs to him. And so in Genesis 49, we have the statement that the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a ruler from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And people have puzzled over that. What does that mean, Shiloh comes? Is Shiloh a name representing Christ in some way? Some will try to translate it until he comes to Shiloh. But I believe that most interpreters, this phrase here in Ezekiel gives us the clue for the meaning of the Shiloh we find there in Genesis, and then it means until the one to whom it rightfully belongs. So it's interesting how Ezekiel here, this particular passage, has thrown this light upon that important thing in Genesis, which has puzzled so many interpreters. And so he says, it will not until he comes to whom it rightfully belongs. And then, capital C is a special prophecy against the Ammonites. The Ammonites seem, at this time, when the king decided instead of fighting the Ammonites to attack Jerusalem, the Ammonites seem to have have joined in with them and made it harder for the different lights. And so we have a brief thing here of special talk against the animal. So most of our community is important to come at one point.